From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her book about how nature makes us happier and healthier, Florence Williams writes about one huge research project. They asked tens of thousands of people to record their mood at random times during the day. They got millions of data points, and here's what they showed. People are least happy at work or sick in bed. No surprise. They were most happy with friends or lovers. Makes sense. But Williams says the biggest variable of all wasn't who you were with or even what you were doing. It's where you are. We are happier, significantly happier, when we're outside. But here's the thing. Most of us hardly go outside anymore. Williams' book finds the science behind why nature is good for us. And she's joining us today to talk about it. It's called The Nature Fix. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In some ways, it seems obvious or self-evident that nature is good for us, that being outside in some natural environment rejuvenates us, takes away our stress, makes us think more clearly. But if that's true, and Florence Williams' book is about why it is true, if that's true, why are we spending so much time indoors, away from nature? Well, here's one reason. Williams says we humans are in the middle of the largest mass migration in modern times, away from rural areas toward cities. And it means, she says, that we've pivoted further away from nature than any generation before us. And so her book explores the consequences of us losing that connection to nature. She explores the science of how nature affects our brains and our bodies. And she asks in the book, just how much nature do we need to fix ourselves? The book is called The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. Florence Williams is joining us today to talk about it. She's a contributing editor at Outside Magazine. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, National Geographic, High Country News, among many others. Florence Williams is joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. And Florence Williams, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's such a pleasure to be with you today.
Okay, so before we jump in, start by explaining what got you thinking about all of this. Because you say in the book it started when your husband accepted a job in Washington, D.C., which meant that you would have to leave your home in Boulder, Colorado, which is there's a big difference there.
That's right. We had spent 2 decades living in the Rocky Mountains. I was really spoiled. You know, I lived right next to a mountain trail, right in the town of Boulder, North Boulder. I used to hike up this trail almost every day. And, you know, I think I sort of, you know, took it for granted that you know, this was just a beautiful place. We, you know, you live in the West, you know how great it is.
Yeah.
And he was recruited for a job in Washington, D.C. We had to think about it really hard. And, you know, we decided to go for it. But it was a surprise to me when we arrived in Washington just how much I felt like my body and my brain were sort of under assault. Just because of the environment. You know, the noise levels. I had never thought of myself as someone who was particularly, you know, bothered by noise.
You grew up in New York City.
I know. Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
But I grew up on the 11th floor of an apartment building.
Okay.
I guess I had thick windows. And yeah. I think, too, you know, at different times of our lives, we are more sensitive,
right,
you know, to certain environmental changes. And I guess, you know, for whatever reason, I seem to be more sensitive to noise than I used to be. You know, and it's, you know, it's a big city. So it's a Euclidean kind of lots of straight lines,
yeah,
lots of concrete, lots of asphalt, lots of traffic. That was one of the hardest adjustments I also had to make, was learning how to drive in that and feeling stressed out about it. You know, and I felt like my nervous system really responded. I wasn't sleeping so well. I felt, you know, kind of anxious. I felt depressed. I wasn't concentrating very well. And, you know, I just started to think about how much I was missing those mountain hikes and, yeah, how much I was sort of craving, you know, a view, an expanse of green. And it just got me really thinking about the connections between our environment and our mental state.
You say after the move in the book, you started to realize that if you were going to explore the effect of nature on the brain, which is what you were thinking about, you had to first acknowledge what its absence means. What do you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's one thing to say nature makes us feel great, you know, when we're in it. But like I said, I was really spoiled. I hadn't lived, you know, in such an urban environment. And I think, you know, part of it with the loss is that I don't think we're so mindful of how we sort of spend our hours, of how we spend our days. You know, we allot our time in ways that, you know, may feel efficient or may feel like we get things done. Mm-hmm. But may not be the best for us in the long term in terms of our mood, in terms of our relationships, you know, and so noticing that this was missing really helped me think about it in a new way.
So what was the thing that you really wanted to, you know, get at? If you boil it down, what was the thing you wanted to not confirm, but at least explore?
Well, I think it really had to do with this idea of the nervous system.
Yeah.
And I was interested, I became, I guess, really interested in the idea of biophilia. Mm-hmm. You know, was that real? And biophilia is a term that was coined by Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson. And what it is essentially this idea that humans are born with an innate love for natural and living things. So living animals, living plants, that we are born with this sort of natural alignment. And yet, if we don't sort of cultivate it at an early age, we can lose it, you know, like some other instinctive drives that we have. And so I became very, very interested in this idea of loss too, and generational loss, because now, you know, we have entire generations of children that really don't go outside in the way that we did when we were younger. And so I think I, you know, became especially interested and sort of passionate about this idea of what are we doing to our children, you know, in addition to what we're doing to ourselves in our daily lives.
You also write this early in the book that you wanted to understand, here's how you put it, how we could get enough of nature in our lives in order to be our best selves. Explain what you mean by that, because that's another important idea that you were after. Like, we're just not ourselves when we're not connected, I guess?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for the reporting for the book, I was really fortunate to be able to travel in many places around the world that have, you know, sort of a longer track record than we do in this country of studying the kind of the physical effects and the physiological, psychological effects of being in nature and what happens when we're not in nature. And I think it was so interesting to me to find out that, you know, other countries just take this a little bit more seriously, looking at, you know, the effects on our nervous system, looking at the effects on our health. And I think it just really drove home to me that, you know, the way we structure our lives is, as I said, to be sort of efficient and to be really productive. And maybe we need to step back and just take a bigger look at, you know, at sort of what it means for us in terms of, you know, how well we function as people, as humans.
You mentioned that our kids aren't going outside as much as they used to. We're probably not as much as we used to. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. And is it true, by the way, we actually check our phones like 1,500 times a month? Is that true?
I have a teenager now, and I can tell you, I think he really does.
Yeah.
He's 15. Yeah, I guess girls are supposed to even check their phones more than boys do, but my son is checking it all the time. A funny statistic I ran across there is that people with iPhones apparently check their phones 26 minutes more per day than people with Android phones.
Yeah.
And I said that was a good reason to marry someone with an iPhone.
Exactly. Well, you call this mass generational amnesia.
What's happened in our, you know, incredible migration, not only to cities, but our migration indoors, is that we're not really noticing it. We're not really paying, I think, adequate attention, you know, to this really phenomenal change in our habitats. As of 2008, more than half of the global population now lives in cities than lives in rural areas.
Right.
So, I mean, this is really a profound shift in kind of the human habitat. And yet it's going so little remarked upon. I know that, you know, I've seen statistics where if you ask mothers today how much time they spent outdoors as kids, 79% of them report going outside as kids every single day. And yet, if you ask them again how much time their children spend outside, only 29% say their children go outside every day. And that's just one generation. So that's just a profound shift. And I don't feel like we're paying adequate attention to that, because it does have, you know, impacts on how we feel.
You also say, and we'll come back to this a little bit later on the program, that we're not really taking into account our connection to nature in the way we design our buildings, in the way we, you know, our architecture, our workplaces. We're not really taking that into account there either.
Right. And I think this gets to the larger question, you know, why are we so oblivious? Why do we have this amnesia? And I think it's because we don't understand, we don't recognize how good nature makes us feel. And this is kind of a, you know, it's sort of a classic psychological paradox in a way that we aren't always the best judges of what is good for our brains, you know, what's good for ourselves. For example, we think it will make us feel good if we go shopping or if we watch a lot of television. And so we undervalue how good nature will make us feel, and we overvalue how good other things make us feel. And that's been shown in some really interesting studies, actually. And so because we sort of undervalue it, you know, we don't integrate nature into our institutions in this country. In other countries, they do a much better job of this. You know, I went to Asia, I went to Japan, I went to South Korea, I went to Singapore. Fascinating ways that those communities, those cultures incorporate nature into their homes, into their workplaces, where we think of nature as something kind of outside.
Yeah. Let's start with Japan. And I was just, I'm trying to figure out the best way to introduce this section. And here's what I came up with. You went to Japan to do some forest bathing. Explain what that is.
Yes. I got an assignment from Outside Magazine shortly after I moved to Washington, D.C. to go write about this obscure and kind of embarrassing practice called forest bathing that the Japanese do. And what it is really is it doesn't involve removing your clothing or anything, but just hanging out in the forest, maybe strolling or sitting, and really opening all five senses to the woods. And so really paying attention to what it is you're smelling, what you're hearing, you know, the feel of the breeze on your cheek. And by paying attention to it, and I thought this was really interesting, by paying attention to your senses, basically what you're doing is learning to be mindful in an environment. And then that enables you to maximize the benefits pretty quickly.
Yeah. There's this Yoshifumi Miyazaki. He's this... he's a physical anthropologist, and he was one of the people that you talked to about this forest therapy. What I found really interesting about this is this exchange that you had with him, and you asked him why it is that the Japanese think about nature so much. And he kind of looks at you and he says, well, don't Americans think about nature? which I think reveals... Maybe talk a little bit about that exchange, because it reveals a cultural difference, which I think is important.
That's right. I felt like he was kind of this Zen Buddhist in a way. You know, he would say something that made so much sense, but it's really out of the sort of normal framework, you know, under which we think things. And of course, he was like, hey, we are a part of nature. We've always been a part of nature. We always will be a part of nature. Why do you even ask that question? Why do you think nature is something different?
Yeah.
And again, I think it gets to that, you know, our culture, you know, Western Judeo-Christian culture, you know, we have been trained for millennia to think that nature is something we dominate. It's something that we utilize, that we exploit for our own benefits. The wilderness was believed to be something, you know, kind of dark and evil. And I think the Japanese just, you know, had a much more benign and, you know, sort of a way of interacting with the world that really valued beauty in a way that we really don't.
You talk about how this area of study used to be thought of as soft science. And there are moments really throughout the book at various parts where you wonder if it isn't a little, you know, touchy-feely, woo-woo, squiggly, whatever the
right,
term
totally.
Is.
Yeah.
But they have findings. I mean, I guess how did you find the balance in all of that? Because you're a science writer, so you have a good healthy dose of skepticism, but
yes.
So how did you deal with that, I suppose?
Well, one of the things I was skeptical of right off the bat that I think a lot of people are skeptical of is, you know, how do you really kind of drill down and identify nature as the kind of beneficial force? You know,
yeah.
Why isn't it exercise, or why isn't it, you know, a lack of, for example, air pollution? You know, maybe it's the absence of bad things that make us feel good. And so, I ask those questions too. But slowly, I was convinced by some of the studies. Of course, researchers ask those questions too. And so they design their studies accordingly to the extent that it's possible. It's not always easy to study the effects of nature on the brain.
Yeah.
But in the Japan studies, for example, they really controlled for the exercise piece by doing studies in which they sent volunteers to walk in the woods for just 15 or 20 minutes. And then a different group to walk in a city, an urban center, for 15 or 20 minutes. And they measured the same things. And they measured cortisol levels, which is a measure of stress. They measured blood pressure, heart rate variability. They also had a number of questionnaires in which the volunteers, you know, would report sort of how they were feeling mood-wise. Did they feel frustration, or did they feel anger, or were they feeling, you know, optimistic or pessimistic? You know, there are these sort of standard psychological tests out there.
Yeah.
And so they were walking the same amount. So presumably they were getting the same exercise. And yet the results were really vastly different depending on which environment they were in.
Talk about the study that took place in Japan about these natural killer immune cells. Because I thought
yes.
This was so, like, this was not touchy-feely. This got to the question of whether nature actually helps you fight infections and maybe even helps you deal with cancer.
Right. Really
practical.
It's not touchy-feely.
Yeah.
It's not touchy-feely, but it's a little bit outrageous, you know, in a way. some of the Japanese scientists are, you know, they're also trying to figure out, well, what is it about nature?
Yeah.
You know, what element in nature is it that's really making us feel better? Is there sort of one piece? Is it the visual? Is it something that we're hearing that's affecting our brain waves? And it turns out that the Japanese are—they're sort of fetishistic. They're just in love with their Hinoki cypress trees.
Yeah.
They have these wonderful forests that are evergreen trees. They smell just terrific. So if you can sort of picture a Christmas tree combined with like Vicks VapoRub, you know, it's a very invigorating aroma. And these are given off by aerosols that are released by the trees. The trees release these chemicals in part as natural defenses against kind of insect invasion. And so they also have these antibacterial qualities. And so it's not totally out of the blue that scientists would kind of want to study if these also affected humans, as they, you know, presumably affect other creatures. And so in one experiment, a researcher, Dr. Ching Li, he put people in hotel rooms and, you know, sort of basically locked them in there overnight or even for a couple of days. And in some of the rooms, he misted, you know, the essential oil from these Hinoki cypress trees. And measured people's these natural killer immune cells that, you know, we need for fighting cancer, for fighting other things. And then the other subjects he had in rooms that just released kind of plain, you know, H2O. And it turns out that in the essential oil rooms, the subjects reported, you know, a far sort of healthier profile of these natural killer immune cells. And he was also seeing the same thing in subjects who walked in the woods after a few days versus walking in the city. And so he like went so far as to make sort of specific recommendations to me. He was like, look, you know, we think that these natural killer cells, we think the elevation lasts for, you know, 7 to 21 days. So if you can go into the woods once a week, that's great. If you can go once a month, that's okay too. It will still elevate your immune system, you know, for up to 3 weeks. And I kind of believe it, I have to say now.
Really?
Because I walk in the woods. Yeah, I mean, I've changed my life. You know, I did take his advice. I walk in the woods, you know, almost every day. And I feel like if I go, I stay pretty healthy. And if for some reason I can't go for a few days, I do. I really start to feel crummy.
Yeah. You say in the book that that as you were looking at, you know, what was happening in Japan, that you couldn't help wonder if having more data on how nature changes our brains and our bodies, you know, that all of this stuff, if we finally get all this data, you couldn't help but wonder if that would actually make more of us go into the woods. What do you think? What does it help? I mean, knowing that it can have some effect on your immune system or whatever, do you think that's going to help get more people out?
I think it really can, but you know, we don't always do what's best for us. We know we're supposed to eat leafy greens, and we know we're supposed to eat broccoli, and we know we're not supposed to, you know, binge watch Netflix or drink, you know, 3 gin and tonics in a row. And of course, we, you know, we do all those things sometimes. But I do feel like, you know, with the nature piece, again, there's this side of us that just doesn't kind of just doesn't acknowledge, you know, how good it makes us feel. And so if we're presented with evidence, that could help. But moreover, I think the evidence could help drive kind of structural changes in society. For example, you know, if we can get schools to actually give kids recess. Yeah. I know where I live in Washington, D.C., only 10% of schools are meeting recess recommendations. So kids aren't getting outside because of schools. It's not just their families. It's not just their own, you know, kind of conflict they may have with wanting to watch TV. It's that their schools aren't letting them out. If we have, you know, workplaces that value this evidence, they can, you know, facilitate more, you know, meetings outside. I mean, Facebook right now has this incredible campus where there are walking trails actually on the roof. And Mark Zuckerberg, you know, takes his meetings outside. There are doctors who are now actually prescribing medicine or prescribing nature as medicine to some of their students. I mean, to some of their patients, especially pediatricians' offices are now encouraging kids to go to the parks that are outside and encouraging their families to go with them. So the benefits are not only reaching the children, but they're actually reaching the whole family and potentially the whole community.
Florence Williams is with us. Her book is called The Nature Fix: Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what nature does for us, what effect being outside has on our brains and our bodies. The writer Florence Williams gets at the science behind all of this. Her book is called The Nature Fix: Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. Well, an important part of this story actually plays out here in Utah. Let's talk about David Strayer. And our listeners may know the name. He's here on the campus at the University of Utah. He's a cognitive psychologist, loves the outdoors. He's a river runner. Talk a little bit about David Strayer and how he fits in this picture. And maybe explain what it's like to go driving with him.
Okay. David Strayer didn't start out studying nature on the brain. Or nature particularly at all. In fact, his specialty is really attention, right, and specifically driver distraction. So he studies, for example, how it affects us if we talk on a cell phone or if we text while we're driving. He also studies these new computer systems that now every car comes with a screen that we're supposed to interact with while we're driving. And I think some of the technology companies don't really love his work because he suggests that, in fact, we are very distracted when we are interacting with this technology. And so because he's interested in attention and how we become distracted and how humans make mistakes, he started noticing that nature may be something that engages our attentional resources in our brain differently. And so I spent some time with him in the desert, which is a place he likes to go. He's a backpacker and a river runner, as you mentioned. And driving down there, you will notice that David Strayer never eats in the car. He never talks on his phone in the car. He's very responsible. He actually made me feel really guilty for even, you know, like having kind of, a meal in the car. He just thinks that's the worst thing.
And he told you not to talk to Siri too, right?
Yeah, he said, don't talk to Siri while you're driving. And I was like, well, I'm not holding it. I'm not using my thumbs. And so what he said was so interesting is that it's the act of speaking that so engages our brains and much of the real estate in our brains that we are actually blind to things that happen in the road in front of us. And so it's not so bad to listen to the radio, for example, because that's kind of passive, it's receptive action. But if we're speaking, then we have a problem.
Yeah. Strayer says that we're products of our evolutionary environment. And so this is what you say in the book, that when we move through any environment, there are these three networks in the brain that we're going through. You've got the executive network, you've got the spatial network, and then you have the default network. And the default network, it seems like that's where we want to be. Talk about that.
Well, the default network seems to sort of control some interesting things that happen to us as humans. The default network is kind of where we daydream,
yeah.
Where we space out. It may be where we come up with really creative ideas. You know, the executive network is where we live most of the time. Mm. You know, we're at our jobs. We are checking things off the to-do list. We're responding to email. For me, I'm looking for parking spaces and not finding them. We tend to kind of really fatigue the executive network in our brains. And that's really different from the way that we evolved in nature, where we may have tasks to do. But, you know, it wasn't like rapid fire, rapid fire, rapid fire. And it wasn't all reacting. You know, we spent also a lot of time sitting around a fire, talking to people, making music. You know, walking through the landscape. I mean, humans are fantastic walkers. We were evolved to walk and walk and walk and walk. And our brains kind of like functioning at the speed of walking. And so when we don't do that, you know, we get fatigued in ways that maybe, you know, we're not so aware of. But we may be just a little impatient. We may be quicker to anger. We may just feel tired. We may be stressed. And we may not be performing at kind of our best cognitive level either.
Mm. We'll come back to David Strayer a little bit later. I want to get to some of these other sections in the book. And one of the ways you organize it is by what you call nature doses. You look at the effect of nature on our senses, sight and sound. And let's start with smell, which gets us to South Korea and this wellness philosophy the country's been working out. Talk to us about your experience in South Korea.
Mm. South Korea, like Japan, you know, has undergone sort of rapid industrialization, and workers there are very stressed out, and students there are very stressed out. So, you know, it's very competitive. The students typically will go to school during the day, and then they'll go to another school at night to sort of give them an edge to get into the very competitive high schools or very competitive colleges. They're learning English. They're not getting a lot of breaks. People report very high levels of unhappiness and depression in both South Korea and Japan. And so the experts there and health experts and the people who are involved with forestry planning are trying to get together to really say, is there a way we can reduce stress, you know, among our populace? And they've actually made some radical changes in the way that they manage the forests accordingly. So typically forests are managed, you know, for timber. What can you cut down? What can you get out of it? How much money can you make? But now South Korea's done this really interesting thing where they've actually designated 37 what they call healing forests that are filled with trails and with so-called healing rangers who are there to actually guide hikers and walkers and visitors through these kind of de-stressing programs. And they have programs for, you know, everything from like kids who are, you know, maybe involved with bullying at school. To you know, like unmarried pregnant women who may be going through stress, cancer patients. I ran into a group of firefighters who were actually doing yoga in the woods these were big men doing sort of partner yoga, which is not something I really expected to see being an American, where, you know, I'm used to seeing sort of men in the woods, you know, hunting things or fishing.
Yeah.
And here they were kind of holding hands and stretching. And these were firefighters with PTSD. So and they just, you know, raved about this 3 days in the woods. They just, you know, told me they wished they could be there for much longer.
Talk about this sense of smell, how that applies here. You say that smell is an undersung but powerful component in all of this. Visuals get the attention, but odor is a really important part of this.
Right. So, you know, you mentioned the nature dose. And when we're in an environment, the smells reach our brain incredibly quickly.
Yeah.
And they can change our sort of wiring really quickly. They can change our mood. They can change our behavior. retail stores have figured this out. You know, sometimes you walk into a store and there will be kind of like a citrus scent that is supposed to make us want to spend more money. Or if you're trying to sell a house, you know, people know that if they put bread in the oven, you know, we'll immediately feel at home. So there are, you know, tricks of the trade that I think psychologists have, you know, put out there into the world. But certainly, you know, these pine trees, these cypress forests, seem to also trigger feelings of invigoration, feelings of calm, and make people feel less stressed, give them more energy, kind of boost their moods. So that's one of the things that I think they're even, you know, figuring out how to commercialize. So now these essential oils, you can find them. You can find like Hinoki cypress toothpaste, for example. And I tried some of this toothpaste, and it's weird because it tastes like you're almost like gnashing a Christmas wreath between your teeth or something.
I wanted to ask you about this part. Here in Salt Lake City, of course, we're afflicted several times a year with terrible air pollution.
Right.
And you write that scientists have come to realize that, and everyone's, you know, freaked out about the effect on our lungs. But you say that scientists have come to realize that it's more than just the lungs, that the nose plays an important part in this too. Would you mention that? Because this is important for people,
sure,
especially this time of year.
Sure, sure. So the nose is this, you know, kind of instant pathway into the brain. And it turns out that particle pollution can also enter our brain really quickly through our nose. And we used to think that pollution just affected people's lungs.
Yeah.
But now scientists are, it's a little freaky. I mean, they're realizing that it can also affect neurodevelopment potentially. It can, you know, create plaques, especially in embryos, for example, in pregnant women. In newborns, their brains seem to be particularly sensitive to some of these particles. We know that diesel pollution actually kills millions of people around the world, this kind of black carbon that comes from unclean burning of combustion fuels. The air pollution seems to actually have much worse effects than we ever realized before. In fact, air pollution in this country kills 3 times more people than traffic deaths.
One of the things you write about is how our sense of smell, and you kind of referred to this earlier in reference to other senses as well, but our sense of smell may be on the wane. So is that true of other senses as well, that if we don't need them in the same way, that they're going to diminish? I mean, there's this process, this idea you write about, that we are self-domesticating.
Yeah, this is a really interesting theory being posited by some anthropologists. You know, certainly our bodies are designed to be adaptive. They're designed to adjust, you know, and maybe put more resources in something and then in something else. We know that, you know, early humans were incredibly strong, you know, had these just like amazingly kind of overdeveloped or what we might consider now overdeveloped, like upper body strength, for example. Some of our senses are just not being used. We don't use them. In fact, when we live in cities, we're kind of turning off, for example, our sense of hearing. How many of us are walking around with earbuds? I mean, I know, especially millennials, like it's really hard to even, you know, talk to them because they just have earbuds on all day long.
Yeah.
So we're designing kind of our own soundscapes. We don't want to smell the garbage, you know. We don't want to smell the traffic. And so in some ways, we're just damping down those senses. We're not using them. And because we're not using them, those neurons, you know, they're disappearing pretty quickly in our development. So there are some researchers I talked to who said that, you know, this is kind of another way we're developing amnesia by not spending more time outside.
I really was thinking about this because when I go, I go on hikes a lot, but I also put in earbuds a lot, listening to, yeah, like lectures and books and podcasts. And
you're multitasking.
I'm multitasking. It hadn't really occurred to me. And you talk about this learned deafness that this is a National Park Service person, Kurt, is it Fristrup?
Yes, Kurt Fristrup. Yeah, he runs a really interesting division of the National Park Service called the Night Skies, Division, and he's also interested in the sounds.
Yeah.
So both the light pollution and the sort of noise environment of our national parks, and his whole point is that by not kind of cultivating these senses, they are disappearing and that we have this learned deafness. And so his whole point is that, you know, once upon a time, we may have been very attuned to, you know, a particular kind of bird song. We may have, like, heard what a bird's song meant. And now we don't even hear the bird song because, you know, we're just not attentive to it in the same way. And so we're just kind of losing these abilities. And to him, you know, it's this great tragedy because we don't even know that we're losing it. So there's this kind of, you know, shifting baseline where we don't know what we've lost.
While we're on the subject of shifting from smell to hearing, would you just say something about how much our brains are like birds? And this Eleanor Ratcliffe, this researcher who plays bird songs in her lab, and how restorative sounds can be. Say something about that.
Okay, yes. Well, birds and humans share a part of the brain that develops speech, and it, you know, it developed differently in humans and in birds. You know, birds obviously came up with bird song, and we came up with words eventually. Yeah. But it's a language. Birdsong is a language, and the human brain really is designed to hear it and to kind of enjoy it. When we hear birdsong, you know, probably deep in our evolution, we woke up to the sound of birdsong, and it meant that all was right in the world. It meant that the world was, you know, the day was going as planned. And in the absence of that birdsong, you know, there may be a kind of a background anxiety that can be easily put to rest by the sound of birdsong.
Yeah.
So there are some kinds of birdsong that we don't find attractive. You know, for example, crows.
Yeah.
Some jays, you know, very kind of husky, raspy kinds of calls. But the sort of chirpy, sing-songy, really linguistic kinds of birdsong, you know, our brains just love. And part of why we love it is because our brains don't actually have to work hard enough to figure out what the language is. It's not like background words, you know, which are distracting because your brain kind of interprets them. So it requires, you know, not that kind of demanding attention, but just a really soft attention that we find on some level very comforting. And she's shown this through tests. You know, you can measure how calm people feel when they listen to different songs.
Yeah.
And I think it was even, you know, Darwin who said, too, that we develop language and birds develop song. This was all part of sexual selection. And so they're really deeply, deeply wired into our brains.
Florence Williams is with us. Her book is The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Florence Williams. We're talking about her book. It's called The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. One more sense I wanted to ask you about because it involves this lovely section where you write about your father who taught you to love nature, even growing up in New York City. while you were researching the book, your father had this accident. He was hit by a car.
Yeah.
I guess this was in the process of figuring all this stuff out. So I guess you knew enough, you say, to ask that his hospital bed be placed near a window. But that gets us to the importance of what we see.
Yeah, so another sense I talk about, of course, is our visual perceptual system, which is our dominant perceptual system. And, you know, I think it's the one we, you know, we naturally think about when we think of ourselves in a natural environment, what appeals to us. You know, it's just kind of what we like to look at. Do we like to look at the ocean? Do we like to look at, you know, a lake, clouds? Mm-hmm. And different people respond to different elements. But yeah, I had been researching this book, and my father, as you say, was hit by a car. He was walking to work, and he broke 7 bones and suffered from a traumatic brain injury. And so he was actually in a rehab hospital for a couple of months, a long time. He lost some of his linguistic ability for a while. And So I knew enough at that point to request a bed by the window. and that's probably because I'd been reading about what we now call window studies. Yeah. And there are a series of window studies, and they actually started in hospitals by looking at hospital records in the 1980s by a psychologist who's also an architect. And his name is Roger Ulrich. And what he looked at were hospital records of people who had gallbladder surgery. And he wanted to know where they were in the hospital during their recoveries. Were they in the rooms that had the beautiful views, or were they in the rooms that had the sort of view of the brick wall? And he just examined past records, and he saw, you know, what was their discharge time? How much pain medication did they ask for? How did the nurses report their kind of moods at the time and their attitudes? And, you know, he found this real difference, that the people who had these tree and grass views were released from the hospital earlier and requested less pain meds. And that launched another series of window studies that people did, for example, in housing projects. People have done them in schools. You know, and the data seems really interesting that when you have kids or adults who are sort of in all other respects equal, you know, pretty equal income, equal levels of education, they just do better when they're exposed to nature, even through a window. It was Florence Nightingale who said this 150 years ago. She said, you know, of course, every patient needs fresh air. They need sunlight. And she would notice the patients would actually, even like very, very sick patients, unconscious patients, would turn their heads to the light, almost like a plant. And yet, you know, in 100 years of medicine, we totally forgot that.
It's interesting how you get at why it is, you know, how that works, how you break this down. And there's this really fascinating physicist named Richard Taylor you write about. And he has this weird obsession with Jackson Pollock paintings, you know, the splatter paintings people know. And Taylor saw fractal patterns in the paint splatters. And anyway, this is a really interesting, it gives us a sense of how deeply connected we might be to certain things. And I just wanted to just say something about this part.
Yeah, this was really interesting. Richard Taylor's he was trained as an artist, but he's also a physicist. From the age of 10, he was obsessed with Jackson Pollock. And at some point, he started studying fractal geometry. And he wondered if the Jackson Pollock paintings conformed to fractal geometry. Mm. Which is basically sort of the ratio of small patterns to large patterns, you know, in a particular, you know, image. So, for example, if you look at a tree, there are little buds attached to, you know, bigger branches that are attracted to larger branches of the tree that are then, you know, in a relationship to other trees. So these kind of similar fractal geometries that are repeated at different scales. And he found that the Jackson Pollock paintings were sort of uniquely fractal, you know, in a particular fractal dimension, and that they elicited a kind of response in the viewer. To him, they made him feel, you know, kind of engaged and excited because the Jackson Pollock paintings are really busy.
Yeah.
But there are other fractal geometries, you know, like waves in the ocean. Or clouds in the sky that are kind of a lower dimension of fractal geometry that elicit what he later discovered to be, through tests, alpha waves. Mm-hmm. That when we look at fractal geometry, it triggers alpha waves in our brains. And alpha waves, you know, are this sort of like holy grail of, you know, Zen Buddhists and, you know, artists who are in flow states. That it's this kind of calm, alert phase. Mm-hmm. That's very prized. And they're not so easy to attain. I tried to attain my own alpha waves by measuring them with a portable EEG unit in various environments, you know, while writing this book. It's not so easy to get alpha waves. But he's convinced that, you know, fractal patterns do it. And that's why we feel so good in nature. You know, all the scientists I talked to had kind of a different, you know, a different theory about what it was. It's kind of like they saw what they wanted to see.
But this is one thing you say, though, in the book, that you found that compulsion to break apart nature and examine it like that. You said it's interesting. Obviously, you're writing a book about it on one hand, but you also found it kind of troubling.
Well, I think sometimes scientists get so into their, you know, specific specialty that it's very reductive. I mean, they want to sort of reduce the answer to like, ah, I found the magic bullet and it's, you know, it's the visual system. Or no, I found it and it's, you know, the nasal system or it's, you know, our auditory system. And after a while, I was like, look, you know, the poets didn't look at it this way. You know, the philosophers didn't look at it this way. You know, maybe we need to look at what happens when we're sort of fully immersed in all of our senses, and that maybe it's, you know, it's not just an ingredient of the soup, but there's something about the whole soup that really makes the biggest difference.
What's the deal with the people of Finland?
What is the deal?
What is the deal with them? I mean, they have this. Maybe we should start with this strange condition they have. I don't even know how to pronounce it. I can see it here on the page. I know it means covered by the forest, but start with that thing.
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it either. Okay. It's kind of spelled Metsänpeto.
Yeah.
And it's this idea that if you're in the woods and you're not sort of appropriately reverential, that you can be overwhelmed by the woods, that they'll sort of immobilize you and make you feel frozen. And you know, the Finnish just have this very deep kind of mythology around the woods. Certainly, you know, for thousands of years, there's this, you know, fabulous kind of also just Norse mythology that's all about, you know, the spirits of the woods. And you see this in a lot of cultures. But the Finnish are somehow still very, very connected to this. Finland was kind of late to industrialization. It's also a very small country where people really still spend time on the land. Everyone sort of still has a grandparent who has a little, you know, fishing shack somewhere that they still go to. They're still very, very connected. And also, one thing cool about Finland is that it's like 70 or 75% forested still. So it's really, you know, highly forested. And it's very flat. So it's not necessarily something that, you know, would appeal to everyone. But the Finns just, they love their woods. They're very connected to them. And they are convinced that they really need to spend time in these woods in order to kind of stave off, you know, the modern ills of obesity and depression and distraction.
So they have this recommendation that people should spend five hours a month?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's right. So the public health researchers there have done a series of studies kind of looking at different levels of greenery. And different times in those different environments. They're really trying to pinpoint specific recommendations. And it just cracks me up because it is so specific. Like they say, okay, we think Finland people, you need 5 hours a month in order, that's a minimum, in order to really ward off depression. And of course, you know, Finland does, like a lot of the Scandinavian countries, even though it's a happy place, they have the sort of paradoxically high rates of depression and suicide. And so they take it seriously because they also believe in preventative medicine. And if they can keep people from getting depressed, then they can actually save their healthcare system a lot of money. So they're putting real dollars into studying this. They're convinced 5 hours a week is it. If you can get more than that, it's better.
Yeah.
But if you can't, if you can just, you know, get out there for 5 hours a week, you will be just fine.
Can you imagine something like that happening here? Like researchers making recommendations to, you know, federal government officials or state government officials to say, you know what Utah really needs is 6 hours a month or whatever. Culturally, you don't think it would work here?
I think it would be tricky.
Yeah.
I am really heartened, though, to see that, you know, like our Department of Interior, the parks, our National Park Service has actually now a pretty new division, and it's called the Healthy Parks, Healthy People Division. You know, and they used to just really care about protecting the resource. It was about, you know, where's the wildlife? How do we protect the park? Or, you know, where should we, you know, put the visitor center? Now it's really about how do we get people into the parks. And how do we maximize what they're getting out of the parks? Mm. So for the first time, the Park Service is now actually also putting some resources, putting some dollars, and enacting some really interesting programs designed specifically to get kids and their parents into the national park system.
It's happening
on a smaller scale.
Yeah. I want to come around finally to this, back to some of the work of David Strayer. There's this study going on that he's done, and one you mentioned from Stanford that says that essentially that when we are in nature, we stop taking ourselves so seriously. Like, we're not self-involved. We're less inclined to be brooding. This is how you put it in the book. The world is bigger than you, nature says, so get over yourself. But you say something about that finally. I think that's really interesting.
I think that's interesting, too. Part of what people are looking at are these mechanisms. You know, what's happening in our brains that's actually making us feel better? And so this really interesting study out of Stanford showed that people who walk in a park, or sort of a park area, it's the Stanford Dish, which is, you know, it's just kind of a basic park, nothing super, you know, dramatic or wildernessy about it. But after 90 minutes in this park, there's a part of their brain called the subgenual prefrontal cortex that actually quiets down. And that's the part of our brain that is very involved in this kind of self-referential, obsessive, ruminative thinking. So, you know, when you're sort of like upset about something, how you just sort of go over it and over it and over it, and you work yourself into like an even worse frenzy. And so psychologists call that rumination. We know that it's linked to depression. So if we can figure out how to reduce rumination, presumably we can really, you know, get better outcomes. They found through brain imaging that when we're walking in a park, that part of our brain quiets down. But when we walk in a city, it doesn't quiet down. Mm. So again, it's not an exercise effect. And then David Strayer, you know, your own Utah cognitive psychologist, he posits that after 3 days in nature, it's something he calls the three-day effect occurs. And that's where something really profound shifts in our brains. And because he's so interested in attention, which is also controlled by that same kind of prefrontal cortex area, he's very interested in figuring out, you know, where that activation is going instead. Because if the prefrontal cortex is getting less activated, what parts of our brain are getting more activated?
Yeah.
And he thinks, and it's hard to prove this now. I mean, he'd love to design more studies to actually see what's happening in the brain. But he thinks it's the parts of our brain that, again, are kind of more involved with dreaming or, you know, long-term goal setting, these ideas of self-concept. You know, who are we? Who do we want to be? You know, where does creativity come from? Mm. And this really grew out of his own experience, you know, as a busy professor, you know, who certainly got a lot of emails to handle every day. He found that when he went into the wilderness for 3 days, suddenly he would get these incredible ideas, you know, that he hadn't had before. That his brain was making new connections. And so he started studying it.
Florence Williams, her book is The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. She joined us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. Florence Williams, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.